Good evening.
Good evening.
It is. It is July. What is it? 26th today of 2017, and this is the courtroom observer's call. And today I'm hoping for a little conversation about the courtrooms, what goes on that courtroom observers need to be aware of, and things they're going to hear from the judge, and maybe the prosecutor, and maybe a few others. And I want to remind everybody that the duties of a courtroom observer are very important, and you can have a great impact on what happens in the courts. Just you by yourself can do it. More people, the better. Singular, though, it can be done. And so I'm saying, look professional. Go in. Just be courteous and social. Don't need to be talking to the judge or the prosecutor unless they talk to you. Smile. Have your clipboard. Be ready to write. Show the judge and the prosecutor that you're ready to write by holding the clipboard for all to see. Have your badge on that says courtroom observer. Shows your picture. And it says National Liberty Alliance at the bottom. Go ahead, write down the judge's name, prosecutor's name, address, phone number, if you've got it. And, whatever information that you have, and be very attentive during the trial. Listen to what the judge has to say. Sometimes it's not easy to hear. I could recommend that if you happen to come across somebody's old hearing aid or something, that can be a blessing. Put that on and turn it up and make sure you can hear. It doesn't record, but at least you can hear and write it. Everybody needs to know that the duty of a courtroom observer is just that, to observe and record and be able to write an affidavit afterwards. We don't want to get into trying to give legal advice to anybody. That just gets you in trouble. I mean, there's people that give legal advice, and then there's people that just observe. And we are the people that observe, so we need to do that job. Leave the other stuff to those people who do it. Is there anyone that would like to start a discussion on?
Yeah, Robert. Hey, this is Goodyear, Oregon. I wanted to follow up with our discussion from last meeting, and you're looking for trying to locate people that would take a leading role in doing presentations for the courtroom observer call. And so there's Terry and there's Michael. Michael actually has a case that he discussed with me, and I think he made a brief mention of it too at the last meeting. So I think it would be nice to include, not if we don't have just one presenter, if we have a couple people that can kind of fill in, Sure, I also have court cases where I'm involved with, and so we're preparing to step up and to help you out with the call. And I've talked with Terry a couple of times, and I've talked with Michael. So I'd just like to defer to them and get their thoughts and feelings on how they'd like to see that that vision come forward to help you in your project with the Courtroom Observer call.
Yes, I appreciate it. Yeah. So go ahead. Let's get a conversation going, and hopefully it's it's information that people can use in doing the work that they do as a courtroom observer and things that will help them.
Am I muted, Robert?
No, I hear you.
Okay. This is Michael Anthony, Watchdog. Yeah, I spoke with Gunther. I spoke with Terry. How you doing?
Yeah, and, doing good, Michael.
Good.
And we kind of discussed the courtroom observer's call, and I think anyway. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's a platform whereby those that have up and coming cases should be able to try to get some suggestions from us on how to proceed, because a lot of them go in without attorneys. And even those that do go in with attorneys, they need to know exactly what the attorneys need to be doing so that they
could. Well, it's not the courtroom observer's duty to give legal advice, but
I wasn't referring to legal advice. I was referring to suggestions for people to maybe give them an idea, like what we use in our cases, how we go about doing it, and our instructions that we give to the attorneys, if there is an attorney that is in the case, because they have a duty to us, whether they realize it or not. And it seems as though their first alliance is always to the court and not to the client.
Well, the attorney does work with the judge and the courts. Their alliance is with the court, and so
right.
If I was going to give any kind of advice, I would say that it would be to not say any more than absolutely necessary, because they tend to take your words and twist them around and start using them against you. And so I think having a good affidavit made up that tends to answer any possible questions, where you can just say, refer to my whatever, you know.
Are you talking on behalf of the defendant, are you meaning?
Pardon?
Are you meaning that statement in regards to the defendant?
Well, yeah. I mean, the defendant, so often they will, you know, they'll hear the judge say something and they think the judge is being nice, and so they start opening up and talking and saying things that they probably shouldn't say. And the attorney on the other side and the judge, they take those words and they twist them up and find you guilty. And so if I was a defendant, I wouldn't want to say any more than I absolutely had to. Just the short answers to questions.
The best approach I've always came up with that works the best for me always has been just asking questions.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is Gunter, if I may interject just shortly. I think what we're looking for is how to When you go into a court, it's good to know as much of the situation as possible. And like what Robert is saying, it is very important. Our counselor at law is very strict with us. He says, be very careful in what you say and be very clear in what you say and understand what you're saying before you say it. You know, so because he said that each word that you put out there has to hit the mark. And so as an observer, basically that's what they're there for. We're there for, to be a presence and to show that we are interested in recording and providing a witness or an observatory type of stance there. So I think that's very important. The other aspect of it is having a good understanding of the case. And that, if you get an opportunity like we have had to actually be tutored by the counselor at law that's representing the defendant, you know, then it adds more weight. When we go into a courtroom, usually there's a lead person that organizes the understanding of what the case is and how we are to proceed. We had one where we actually inferred an injunction to put a stop to a sentencing process. And so one of the members that was designated got up and inferred that the sentencing was not a legitimate sentence, that it needed to be, that the defendant needed to have 24 hours in order to prepare, because they were going to take him into custody immediately, and he had a heart condition. So he was defending himself in that case. So there was a rebuttal to to the custody, the arrest that had happened in the court at the time, and it was specifically planned who was going to say what, you know. So, but to get back on track, I think is for us just to come up with whatever experiences that we've had as court observers, as court witnesses, and then build on what the NLA program has and the tips that Robert Bristow has been working with, so giving to us. So with that, I yield.
Well, that's something that a courtroom observer can be looking at is, you know, if their client is there without an attorney and speaking for himself, you know, they might make notes of his answers and whatnot, and maybe let him know that, you know, hey, I think you're getting too deep into things and saying too much, or maybe you're not being clear enough, or, you know, something like that. So that maybe during a break time or whatever, to where when they go back in, then they can watch a little closer to what they're saying. You know, that's not giving legal advice. That's just being a friend.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it's easy to get lost in the moment and say much more than what's necessary. Even when writing an affidavit, people tend to want to explain what they just said.
Wow.
And you just got to stick with the facts. Tell a story, but just by using the facts.
So, Robert, how can we move forward to help? Michael had talked about a foreclosure case that he was working on. So I wondered if it would be okay to ask that he have the floor and talk about that. And I also have another thing that came up. Gary Will had asked me to do a short presentation on getting to know your officials. And so I've got to kind of dub out for about a half an hour and go on to the Allstate call with Gary and do a little presentation with him. And then I'll be back in about 30 minutes.
All righty. Very good.
Okay. Uh-huh. And then I'll see you guys in a little bit. And Michael, yeah, talk right about your case.
Okay. Hello. Well, somebody talking now?
Hello? Am I unmuted?
Hi. No, you're on.
Okay. Would you like me to speak a little bit about the case that I was with my friend on Friday?
Yeah, let's find out what happened.
Well, it was a foreclosure case, and it's getting really near the end, and it was HSBC Bank. And my friend, who has been fighting this case for the last two and a half years, has filed just about every type of motion, every type of paper that could be filed in the case. It's his father and mother's home, and he wanted to go up and to speak on the paperwork, but they wouldn't allow him to go up to the bench. The mother and father were up at the bench, and the judge, he seemed like a nice guy at first. Well, even to the end, he seemed like he was a nice guy, but you could tell that he was kind of crooked and working with the banks. And HSBC Bank had done the foreclosure. And with the paperwork that was filed into the case, there was a demand to produce the assessment, the notice of proof of claim and evidence of the debt, and to try to make sure that the paperwork was, that HSBC had all the paperwork. Well, they never got any response from HSBC, so HSBC kept calling and harassing the parents for money on the loan. Well, the mother took HSBC to small claims court. And in the small claims court, HSBC furnished to them a certified copy of the fact that HSBC no longer has any interest in their property. And so she said, well, why are we even here? Because HSBC does not have an interest in our house anymore, and this attorney is representing HSBC. And then she spoke up. The attorney did and said, no, I represent some alphabet CDI loan lending type of thing. And she goes, who are you? And she goes, well, we bought it from Fannie Mae. We bought the loan from Fannie Mae, and Fannie Mae bought it from somebody else who purchased it from HSBC. And so the judge was really confused. And at first he said he read all the paperwork, but once that came out, he admitted that he didn't read it all, and he would have to look at it even further. So then what he did, he started reading an affidavit from a different attorney who works for the same company that this lady attorney was there. And she was young. She was really young. And we looked her up on the Internet and come to find out they had eight attorneys in their law firm. Two of them were men, and the rest were women. And the men didn't have the guts to come into court to plead the case or to do anything for the case. So they sent probably the least amount of knowledgeable attorney that they had and threw this lady under the bus. So here she is. She filed no paperwork into the case whatsoever. And it was a case where my friends were the defendants in the case, but they filed a motion to dismiss the case for lack of standing because HSBC no longer has any interest in the property, nor do they have an assignment on the property. And nobody could furnish an assignment, and nobody knows who has the assignment for that piece of property. So my friend's mother, who is not knowledgeable at all in the law, she was just scared to death when she was standing up there, and my friend and I, we were talking in the peanut gallery and trying to get a message to her and her husband on what to say, but she kind of pretty much dropped the ball because the judge had asked her who she's been making payments to, if she has been. And she says, no, well, I haven't been making any payments. And he said, why not? And she just looked at the judge and looked around the courtroom and says, well, I have no idea who we're supposed to make payments to. HSBC says they don't have an interest in the property. They don't have an assignment. And she said, nobody's here from Fannie Mae or this other company, and we've never had any notice on who to send the money to. Do we give the money to you, Judge, or do we give it to the prosecutor, or do we give it to the 8 Erie County sheriffs that are standing in this line, standing inside the courtroom, or give it to some homeless guy? And he just looked at her, and he didn't know what to say. So then he started reading an affidavit from this other attorney. And this other attorney was probably higher than this lady standing in the courtroom from the same firm, and he started reading the affidavit. Well, then the mother said to the judge, she said, wait a minute. She said, that affidavit, she said, the lady who wrote the affidavit is not even here. So how about to cross-examine her? So that isn't that affidavit null and void? And the judge started, he looked at her and he didn't know what to say. And so he put the affidavit down and he said no more about it. So then the lady who was the attorney representing supposedly whatever bank has an assignment, which they don't have, she came right out and she said, I think this is a fatal flaw on her part. She said, well, yes, HSBC is no longer the plaintiff in the case. So therefore, I'm going to amend a complaint against this family and put the proper plaintiff into the case. So I said, you know, the judge, his duty then is to dismiss the case and rule in favor of my friends, and in the alternative, give that attorney an opportunity to refile the claim with the proper plaintiff. So the judge says, well, I'm going to reserve my decision after I investigate this a little farther. So we're pretty excited trying to figure out how he's going to rule in this thing. And if he rules against my friends, they're immediately going to file a notice of error and try to do something to keep it back in the courts, because this is the last hearing before they give them like an eviction notice.
Well, that's, he should have just dismissed the case right then.
Yes.
But this is something that, as a courtroom observer, these are things you should take note of and put in the affidavit.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And the other thing was that the lady, we couldn't figure out why there were at least 8 Erie County sheriffs in the courtroom. And when the court was over with the attorney, she was escorted to her automobile by 3 Erie County sheriffs, one on each side of her and one behind her. And it's like I think she was scared to death, because they know the crimes that they are committing. This is ridiculous.
Absolutely. Absolutely, they know.
And then the father of the husband of the family that's getting their house allegedly taken away, trying to get taken away, we were on the way back, and he said to me, he turned to me in the car, and he says, did you see them guys looking at you? And I says, looking at me? And he says, yes, all those sheriffs were just basically staring at you, because I was writing on my paper on the clipboard. And I said, no, I didn't even notice them. I was too busy writing on my paperwork.
Well, you were doing the proper thing.
They were shuffling their feet and everything. He says they were nervous, really nervous.
And that's a lesson for courtroom observers. You, as an individual, can make those people very nervous. They see it being recorded, what's going on, and they see problems on the horizon.
Absolutely, absolutely. But that was my experience with the foreclosure, and I don't know if it'll do any good to anybody, but it's important that we are there.
That was a good report, because it's a good teaching thing for courtroom observers, things to watch for and to take notes of. And here again, I want to reiterate the need for having some knowledge of the Constitution and common law. It will help you when it comes to what's going on in the court. You'll know more about what is illegal and what's not. more about what you need to take notes on.
Right, right. But this was just a motion hearing. It was just a motion hearing, and it wasn't a trial. Therefore, there was no jury or anything of that nature. And I think probably what will happen in the case is there won't be any trial whatsoever. The judge will just make a decision, and it'll be up to him to state, well, yeah, you get your home taken away or you don't. And
they're either going to be too nervous to go forward, or they're going to try to bluff their way through.
Right.
Because if they dismiss it, that's a bunch of money out of their pocket.
Exactly. But the problem is HSBC, they sold it 3 times. They've been paid for it. And then I believe they also turned it into FDIC and collected on the note that was the original note on the property. So they made out like 4 or 5 different times, plus the securitization of all of the assignments in the securities exchange market.
Well, I think you'll find that the government, when an agent sells you a home, the government turns around and pays them.
Right.
And so the real estate never has a legal case to bring it against you.
Right. And the lady said, it was kind of funny and ironic. She looked at the attorney, that girl attorney, and she said to the girl, she said, well, seeing as nobody from HSBC is here and you claim that you have the interest in the property, she goes, what did you give us? And that girl had a blank look on her face, and I thought she was going to hit the floor with her chin.
Yeah. Not prepared at all.
It's all fraud is all it is.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
I yield. Okay, I'm done. Thanks, guys.
Is this Crystal?
Yes, it is. I'm going to piggyback off what he had to say also. When I came home today, they put the foreclosure sign on my property again. And I just received a letter. Now, when I went to court back in May, when they changed it the last day of May, and I was 2 minutes late, and I stayed in that courtroom all that time, and then I said, well, wait a second, what is my case? And one of the persons said, you know what, I can't understand. They knew you're disabled, and you were coming in, and he dismissed your case and put you off in for the 26th of August. So I went right downstairs, and I put in the reclaim and right of error. Okay. So I didn't hear from them. And then I went back again, and I also had a stamp, so I got my copies. I went back again, was it last week, and I said, this is my second request from June 6, 2017, and I put the identification and everything else down there, reclaim, and also writ of error. Okay? So they send me all this paperwork and stated that they never received it, but yet I got it stamped both times, and they put an X through this one here. Okay? I also asked for the sworn notarized affidavits from Mr. GE Federal Credit Union when I purchased the property and the copy of the deed, which I got no kind of response. So I am to return back to court on the 7th of August. And now they want to sell my house for, I paid $153 for my house in 2000, and they want to sell my house. They want me to give them another $150,000, which my house has been paid for. And in 2002, my property was assessed at $260,000. Now it's worth about maybe close to $600,000-$700,000. It's the land. And so I've been doing even the appraisals because I used to work in that department. There's something I think everybody should be aware of, too, that came out on the news last week about Donald Trump on all his property. For example, the property in New Jersey, he paid $65 million for the 300 acres. And the attorneys, in turn, reassessed the property at $6.5 million, way under assessment. So on all his properties here in the United States, his assessment is under $40 million. So what a big chunk he's saving on taxes. I did and put the whole Board of Appeal together for our county, and I won the whole case. There was 19 attorneys, and not one of them knew how to do that. You know, and when I presented the case, I won the case. So I'm very much aware of the reevaluation. Cost of living goes up, just like our minimum wage from 1974 to now. It should be $38 per hour. Cost of living goes up. They brought our income back down to the mid 80s. You know, and it's just like I did a case even with the Social Security and the judge asked me, he goes, well, what do you have to say for yourself? And when I presented, he was like really shocked at how I put the whole thing together. And I said, it's impossible. So what I was making then, I'm only down to 18% of my salary, which you're doing to everybody, and you can't survive off that. But with this here, so I have to go to court again on the 7th. And again, and I said, the assessment of this property. So they got it already in line. So they're telling me I could walk away with, first was $69,000, now it's $50,000. And now they want me to pay $150,000. So they got $22,000 on legal fees and all this other bourgeois stuff here. You know, so I just got this today. You know, but so I'm going to go back and submit it again. But, like, they want to take my house on the 26th. And I've had my house 17 years. And it's the same. Nobody signed off on it. But it was, his name is, oh, God, what is the judge's name? Arthur Jennings. And he's been the one taking everyone's home, but he's only part-time. I asked him for his oath and bond number, and he goes, that's not necessary to know. It is whatever it is, you know? And, again, I asked him for the sworn affidavits, and they keep on changing up with the different attorneys again. You know, because I said, can I have a sworn notarized affidavit? And I asked, I said, I would like to speak to Mr. GE Federal Credit Union. And I called for the payoff. And another thing, too, I found out, too, about our CUSIP number and our Social Security Trust. Have you ever heard of that? And that's what they've been using, our names, because everybody has a trust, a Social Security Trust, and everything's already been paid for. Like my mortgage, the last time I was in the courtroom, he asked the attorneys, because it's only between the attorneys and the judge. You have no trial. I asked for a common law grand jury of my peers, you know, and it's just like they talk across the table. Up on the 6th floor, they go and make the settlements on everybody's cases, and the clients aren't even there. And that's when we caught that, you know. So we were all up there like, well, wait a minute. Where are the clients? And that's when I found out they settled two cases of mine without my knowing. And I got the transcripts. And I'm like, I just got that for my last case, that when I asked for that common law grand jury, so much stuff came out. So, I mean, so many people are getting duped left and right. And it's just like the judge asked, at that last hearing back in May, he asked the attorneys, is this a MERS case? MERS? And he said, if it's a MERS case for a mortgage, he doesn't want it. That's the one that they scan your name and there's no signature
date.
I'm sorry?
They robo-sign it.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. He said he wasn't touching no more of those. And he asked all the attorneys about that.
Crystal, do you have any proof that they paid the mortgage off with your CUSIP, from your CUSIP number and your Social Security TrustEQ trust account?
Well, that's when they started changing my mortgage because I got all my paperwork. You know,
Is there anything documented in that paperwork to verify that what you said? We know they're doing that, but what we need is documentation.
Okay, like the PHH mortgage. Okay. They were the first ones. That's when I realized it in 2006, and I got the payoff for $77,000 for my house, right? And when I got my deeds from the town hall in Trumbull, PHH is not even on there. When I did the conference call with my former attorney, and I said, you know, they were like, well, what happened? How they go? Because I'm the one who did my mortgage. I did it for a fixed rate when I bought my house for 15 years. No prepayment penalty, you know, because my husband was a bank manager. So I know a little bit more than the average Joe Schmo, you know, and I've owned quite a bit of properties. And then when I asked, I remember one thing, you know, I said, you can never change no one's mortgage unless you sign, you know. And so I had the attorney, he was asking all the questions. I said, do me a favor. I want to ask the very last question. And so he let me ask the last question. I told him the question I was going to ask him. So the CEO and the, you know, the people on the other end, because you had to identify everybody who was on the phone because it was a phone conference call. I said, I would like to know who signed my name to change my mortgage. All of a sudden he goes, you know what, we made a mistake, and they sent me my paperwork, and it was released. And I got that.
So can you put that in your case? Does that have a bearing and a weight in that court that you're in?
No. See, we don't have no sheriffs in our state. Connecticut did away. I've been in contact with our Congress, Richard Blumenthal, Hines, and all the rest of them. And it's just like they're all screaming about what's going on with the Republican, but the other, one's no better than the other because they're all a part of this scam. You know?
Right.
But more and
right,
more people
right.
are finding out about this CUSIP and this Social Security. It's called Social Security Trust. Your Social Security Trust.
That's the Q Trust.
And that's the CUSIP, yeah. But everybody's been talking about it. And I'm like, wait a minute. You know? So does anybody got any input for me as far as when I...
I don't know what you can do to stop them.
Well, I could file Chapter 13 or resubmit my claim from the Chapter 11, but I am going to take this paperwork back to them because of right of error, and they did not respond. And now, as a matter of fact, they crossed out, because I just got this tonight, by assistant clerk. They crossed out the assistant clerk, and they go, they have M.A. Sawkowski, or whatever his name. But they're not the clerk. And it says return does not list no motion number to reclaim, no motion to reopen judgment file.
Well, I would have a writ of error already filed or ready to go in the event that that judge does something under color of law against your property. Did you do by any chance a quick claim deed?
A quick claim deed?
Yeah.
I can do a quick claim deed.
That may save it. That's what my friend is doing as we speak in the case that I was in on Friday.
Okay.
And I think you might want to speak with John on that, but I do believe that would be an alternative for you
mm-hmm.
to look into. And that would put a hold on the property whatsoever right then and there.
Okay. And the writ of error.
Yep. Definitely have a writ of error because they don't have the authority to do what they're doing. And the list of things that John spoke about on Monday night on that call, he pretty much detailed it, hook, line, and sinker. That was probably one of the best calls I've heard since I joined the group.
Mm-hmm.
He hit a home run. Now he hit a grand slam on that one.
And the writ of error, okay. And I gave him...
But the very beginning of the call, he was really on point, talking about all these court cases and what these judges are doing, and you could put that in the writ of error if you, you know, just listen to the call again, the beginning of it.
Okay. I'm going to get that down there right away.
Yeah.
Because, see, you know what? I did the writ of error, and they did not respond, and when I put this one in last week, I guess I thought I put Rhoda here, but I didn't. But I'm going to bring it right back tomorrow.
Right. They can't respond.
I'm going to do this again tomorrow. Right, the Vera. Very good.
Right.
Okay.
Good luck, sweet.
All right, and I will be in touch. And, you know, but I'm praying and... and I'll just try to get this taken care of as quickly as possible.
Now, when's your case again? When's your...
They want me back in court the 7th of August, and they want to auction my house off for $20,000 down payment, and they want to let my house go for $200,000, which, where the town I'm in, the house is worth close to $500,000, if not more.
Now, are they going to sell that on the steps? Are they going to sell it at the fire department or on the steps of the courthouse?
No, they're going to come to my house. And they told me
they're
going to
sell it at your house?
Yeah, they want to come to my house and they want to come inside my house. And I'm not going to let them in.
But when they sell it, where are they going to sell the property at?
Here.
Right there. Okay. What you would need, another thing you can do is to print out a whole bunch of caveat emptors. Caveat
print
emptor
out a what?
Caveat emptor. A piece of paper with caveat emptor, buyer beware. And then you can list the violations, the constitutional violations that is going along with the stealing of your property and make sure everybody has that in their hand because they're going to walk away from it. They're not going to want to buy any piece of property that has a legal liability to it.
But it's
and that you... caveat emptor, CAVEAT, one word. Next word is emptor, EMPTOR.
Wait, enter?
Emptor, EMPTOR, caveat emptor.
Okay, beware?
Buyer beware. You're giving whoever wants to buy that property notice that there's a legal liability that's going to contain that property. And you are going to come after them for conspiring to defraud you in the theft of your property.
Okay. Okay.
And then you sign your name on it that you are the legal lawful owner of that property. And nobody has any claim against it. And it's all done by fraud. You put that right on the paper.
Legal, lawful owner. This is fraud. Just right, this is fraud?
They're taking your property through fraud. Yeah, color of law. Under color of law through fraud.
Hey, Crystal?
Yes?
There's something you should be aware of with regard to this foreclosure auction. Now, the bank says that you owe, like, something like $200,000 on the property. Is that correct?
No.
How much are they saying that you owe?
It was $109,000.
Only $109,000, right?
Right.
Okay. here's what's going to happen. Is a lot of times what they do is at the auction, they have what they call an upset price. That means the discount that they're willing to take on the loan. So even though you might owe $109,000, they might put it up for auction for like, what they'll usually do is they'll bid $100 on behalf of the bank. But they usually announce the upset price in the beginning of the auction. And that is the amount that they are willing to take for the property. Now, that may only be $25,000, it may be $50,000, it may be $75,000. But very rarely do they ever try to get the whole amount. So, you know, I don't know if you know anybody, but, you know, you may be able, you know, I know this because you're going to be doing other things, is that it is possible for somebody to go in there and buy that property for a lot less than what you owe to the bank. And the reason that they announce the upset price in the beginning, at least in New Jersey, is because they don't want people bidding against the property. Because what happens is, as this property is bid up, the bank is required to pay a commission based on the amount of the money they received for the property. So if somebody, if you have a bunch of people bidding on a property, the mortgage company pays more based on, you know, how high the bidding goes in the form of a commission to the sheriff. But if they only bid $100 and nobody comes in and bids against the bank, then they get the property back for $100. So it's a windfall for them when nobody else bids on the property.
So they're going to bid on this. No, right.
Because what happens is a lot of times they'll say, well, okay, the upset price is $50,000. And somebody will bid it up to $49,000 and drop out. And that causes the bank to have to spend more money in the form of a commission to the sheriff.
And see, I never even took a mortgage with these people. I said, can I please see, I would like to see a sworn notarized affidavit with Mr. G. Credit. They never had a mortgage with them. Then they said, oh, the fire department credit. The fire department credit union, they ripped me up on $250,000, and who got the money? And then they went out of business.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
No,
they got
no.
$250,000, and I never got 1 cent. And I'm like, wait a second. Who did you have to pay off? Because it wasn't PHH mortgage, because I never even had no mortgage with them. This is where the scam began, because my house was just about almost paid off. Because I sold my other properties. And then they changed my fixed mortgage into a variable mortgage. And this is when the Ponzi scheme with all these fools began. And I was going through so much, my husband dying. I was just going through a whole lot of stuff at that point, not even realizing. When I sat down, I'm like, wait the heck, you know. I realized, you know what I'm saying? It was just like, I was duped, you know, because, again, I was nervous. I'm like, where did all this come from? And here, I worked in the assessor's office. I did this work, you know? And as I said, you know, when you just freeze and you're overwhelmed with everything, that's what happened in my life at that point.
Nothing.
And then I was sick with the cancer. Huh?
No.
It was just so much going on.
I called the cops. Okay. What did you answer? And I said, okay, I'm asking for
reassurance. But John's supposed to send those other paperwork so I can get that and file. Okay. Anything else on that? But I thank you for your input. And
okay. Does Does anyone else have anything?
No, I had sent John some. I just wanted to make sure he received that also for National Liberty Alliance. Because, as I said, I realize it's a lot of work and it's a big expense, and I've been telling everybody to donate because, you know, it's a lot.
Okay, well.
So, Gerard or John. I'm sorry.
If nobody has any.
If, Kev, because somebody sees it, just let me know. Because I sent him something, and I just wanted to make sure he got it. If he didn't, I got to put a cancellation on it. Because things that have been sent in the mail, people are not receiving it, and things are being stolen. So if you ask John, did he get the care package I sent, let me know, please.
Okay, well, I'm gonna stop the recording.